So, just real quick before we jump into things today, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
Yeah, they really are. They've got a full Series 3 course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and these unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing.
Right, which is super important.
Exactly. So, check it out at certfuel.com. Anyway, let's get right into it. I want you to imagine this for a second.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
You have just spent, I don't know, $500,000 on tractor fuel, specialized fertilizers, and some crazy genetically modified seeds.
That is a lot of cash out the door.
Right. You've spent weeks working these brutal 16-hour days just planting your entire field.
Yeah.
And now you wait.
Just sitting there.
Yeah, literally, you've absolutely zero to show for it right now, except, dirt and a massive mountain of debt.
Sounds super stressful.
Oh, it gets worse.
Yeah.
You know that a single massive rainstorm in July, or I don't know, a sudden change in global trade tariffs could ruin everything.
Yeah, or like an unexpected bumper crop in Brazil just flooding the market.
Exactly. Any of that could
Yeah.
completely wipe out the value of what you're growing. You could literally go bankrupt before you even harvest a single ear of corn.
Which is terrifying.
It is. So, how do you insure something that doesn't even exist yet? How do
Yeah.
you protect, like, a phantom asset?
That is the million-dollar question.
Welcome to the deep dive. If you're listening to this right now, we know your mission. You are here to absolutely dominate the Series 3 exam.
Dominate it.
Yeah. And today, we're zeroing in on Chapter 1. We are tackling the absolute most notoriously flippable, mind-bending material in the entire first section of the curriculum.
Oh, you mean anticipatory hedges?
Yep. Anticipatory hedges and those incredibly tricky long or short the basis concepts.
Ah, the basis. That breaks so many people's brains. And just to give you some context on why we're spending our entire time together on this specific slice of the material, part one of the exam, which is chapters 1 through 7, that accounts for roughly 71% of the entire exam weight.
Wait, 71%? That's massive.
I mean, yeah. Now, the National Futures Association, the NFA, they don't publish the exact per unit weights, but that 71% figure tells you everything you need to know about where you need to focus your energy.
You just cannot afford to drop points here.
No, you really can't.
Exactly. But here is the core problem. And, well, it's why we're going so impossibly deep today. This specific material is the single most direction flippable material on the entire test.
Oh, 100%. The exam writers are basically setting up psychological booby traps for you.
Right. They will try to pair a hedger with the completely wrong futures leg. Or they'll try to flip the basis label on you.
Or they'll try to confuse you on the definition of what weakening actually means. It is designed from the ground up to make you second guess yourself under pressure when that clock is ticking.
It really is. It plays on cognitive dissonance.
Right.
But the promise we're making to you today is this: by the end of this deep dive, you won't just be memorizing dry rules.
Right, no writing down cheat codes that you don't actually understand.
Yet you are going to understand the actual why behind the mechanics. Once you see the underlying logic, those exam traps become completely transparent.
You'll see them coming a mile away, and you'll be able to dismantle them effortlessly.
Okay, let's unpack this. We need to start with the fundamental concept of not yet.
I like that. Not yet.
Because logically, we have to establish what an anticipatory hedge even is before we can figure out who uses it and why they're using it. So, how do we define this core term for the purposes of the exam?
Well, at its most basic foundational level, an anticipatory hedge is a strategy that protects a cash market position the hedger expects to hold but does not yet hold.
Okay, does not yet hold.
Right. That is the crucial distinction. The physical commodity they're protecting is either a growing crop that hasn't been harvested yet, or it's inventory that they know they will need but haven't actually bought yet. It's all in the future.
Okay, wait, I have to push back here. And I think this is where a lot of people's brains, kind of short circuit when they first read the material.
Sure, lay it on me.
If I don't own the thing yet, how is this different from just gambling?
Oh, I see what you mean.
Or, purely speculating in the futures market? Like, if I don't have the physical corn in my hand, aren't I just betting on corn prices?
It sounds like it, yeah.
Why does the CFTC or the NFA look at this and say, ah, yes, this is a legitimate hedge, rather than treating me like a day trader placing a bet at a casino?
That raises an essential question, and it's a very common point of confusion that the exam loves to exploit.
I bet it does.
The reason this is treated by regulators, the exchanges, and the market as legitimate hedging and strictly not a speculation is because the physical commodity is genuinely on its way.
On its way.
Okay, sure. It's tied to a real, tangible business necessity. The hedge is covering anticipated production that the hedger is currently growing. Or it's covering anticipated requirements.
The anticipated requirements, meaning what exactly?
Meaning unfilled needs for a manufacturing process that are already scheduled and budgeted for a forward window.
So let me get this straight. It's the difference between me, like a podcaster, just deciding to buy wheat futures because I read some Bloomberg article about a drought in Russia.
Right, which would be pure speculation.
Versus a commercial bakery buying wheat futures because they literally have contracts signed to bake 10,000 loaves of bread next month.
Exactly.
They have the flour mills on speed dial, and they absolutely will need the wheat to fulfill those orders.
Nailed it. The bakery has a legitimate, unavoidable business exposure to the price of wheat, even if the wheat isn't sitting in their pantry today.
Their profit margin is entirely dependent on what wheat does between today and the day they place the physical order.
Yes. So, to really lock this in, let's contrast this directly. Let's look at an ordinary hedge versus an anticipatory hedge.
Okay, lay it out for us.
An ordinary hedge protects something that is already in your hands. For example, imagine a massive mountain of grain that is already harvested, dried, and sitting safely in a commercial grain elevator or a warehouse.
Right, because they are holding the bag, literally. They possess the physical asset today.
Yes. The owner of that physical grain uses an ordinary hedge. An anticipatory hedge, on the other hand, protects something that is on its way to your hands.
Like the growing crop we talked about.
Exactly. Think of a crop that is still growing in the dirt, absorbing sunlight and water, or inventory, you know, you have to acquire, but just haven't signed the final purchase order for yet.
But because it's not in your hands yet, because it's a phantom asset, there has to be a bit more risk involved, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, you know, the saying, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. With an ordinary hedge, the grain is safe in a steel bin. With an anticipatory hedge, you are hedging something that might not even materialize.
Precisely. And what's fascinating here is how the real world views that uncertainty. Anticipatory hedging inherently carries a bit more structural risk than ordinary hedging.
Why is that? Just because of the weather?
Because reality happens. The anticipated crop could completely fail due to a drought or a flood, or that bakery's anticipated need could suddenly change if a major supermarket chain cancels a massive bread order.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
If that happens, the physical side of the equation just disappears into thin air.
And if the physical side disappears, you're left holding this massive futures position with nothing to balance it out.
Exactly.
Which means you instantly transition from being a conservative hedger to being a naked speculator without even making a trade.
Yes, you are suddenly exposed to infinite risk on the future side, and you have no physical commodity to sell to offset it.
That is wild.
There's actually a famous historical case study in the 90s, Metallgesellschaft AG. It was this massive German conglomerate.
Oh, I think I've heard of them. What happened?
Well, they were doing a complex version of anticipatory hedging. They were selling forward contracts for oil and hedging them with short-term futures. The market structure flipped. They got hit with billions in margin calls on the futures, and the anticipated physical cash flow they needed to cover it hadn't materialized yet.
Billions? Are you serious?
Yeah, it nearly bankrupted a century-old company, so the risk of not yet is very, very real.
Okay, listen up. I want to break the fourth wall for a second. If you are taking the Series 3 next week, you need to circle this next concept in red ink.
Get the red ink ready, guys.
The exam writers love to exploit a specific blind spot right here. They are going to try to trick you into thinking that an anticipatory hedge uses different market mechanics than an ordinary hedge.
Yep, they do it all the time.
They'll present a question that makes you think, oh, because the crop isn't harvested yet, I must have to use some weird alternative futures contract or trade in the opposite direction.
Do not fall for it.
Do not fall for it.
Yeah.
It does not change the mechanics.
That is a critical takeaway. An anticipatory hedge is defined entirely by the timing of the cash position, not by different mechanics in the futures market.
Right.
The mechanics, meaning whether you hit the buy button or the sell button on your trading terminal, they stay exactly the same as an ordinary hedge.
All right, let's make this real. We need some characters.
Mm-hmm.
We need to see how this actually plays out in a spreadsheet in the real world. Let's look at the anticipatory short hedge.
I love a good character. Who do we have?
To do this, I want you to picture Farmer Fred.
Farmer Fred. Got it.
Farmer Fred is a commercial corn farmer. Let's say it's April. As we said in the intro, he just spent a small fortune on tractor fuel, fertilizer, and high-yield seeds.
Right.
And he just finished planting his entire 5,000-acre field. He has absolute zero harvestable corn in his hands right now. It is just seeds in the dirt.
Okay, so Fred has a massive cash outlay. Hmm. His bank account is completely drained. He has a field full of biological potential, but no actual product to sell today.
Exactly. So I have a direct question for you, the listener. I want you to pause your brain and think about this for a second.
Put yourself in Fred's shoes.
Put yourself in Farmer Fred's muddy boots. He has corn growing in the dirt. What is his absolute biggest financial nightmare between now and October? Let me give you a beat. Think about it.
Did you figure it out? His biggest nightmare, the thing that keeps him staring at the ceiling at 3 a.m., is a massive price decline before the harvest.
A massive price decline.
Right. He's going to spend the next 6 months growing this corn. His break-even cost, let's say, is $4.80 a bushel.
Okay, so he needs at least $4.80 just to not lose the farm.
Exactly. If the global price of corn falls off a cliff between today and harvest day and corn drops to $3 a bushel, he is going to sell his crop for drastically less than it cost him to grow it. He would lose the farm, literally.
Right. So because Farmer Fred knows he will have output to sell later and he knows his margins are tight, he needs to lock in a selling price right now, today, while prices are decent. Let's say December corn futures are currently trading at $5.50. That gives him a nice profit over his $4.80 break-even. How does he lock that in?
He takes action by selling futures. He goes short in the futures market.
He goes short. Okay, let's define his positions clearly using the exact terminology the NFA will use on your exam.
Yes, the exact phrasing is crucial here. In the cash market, meaning the physical world of actual yellow corn, Farmer Fred has a long anticipated cash position.
Long anticipated cash,
yeah.
Which sounds crazy because he has no cash and no corn yet.
It is totally counterintuitive, but he is long the cash market because he will own the physical commodity once it is produced.
Okay, I'm with you.
When you are long the physical commodity, your fear is always that the value of that commodity will drop.
So here is the offset mechanism, and we need to walk through the math because this is the absolute magic of hedging.
It really is magical when you see it work.
Okay, it's April. December corn futures are at $5.50. Fred sells enough futures contracts to cover his expected crop yield.
He's locked in.
Fast forward to October. The harvest is in, but Fred's nightmare has come true. South America had a record-breaking crop, supply is flooding the market, and global corn prices have plummeted.
Right. The cash price at his local grain elevator has crashed to $4 a bushel. It's well below his break-even of $4.80.
He takes his physical corn to the local elevator, he unloads it, and he gets a check for $4 a bushel. He takes a massive, devastating loss on his physical farming operation.
Ouch.
But yo, T, we have to look at his other account. Remember that futures contract he sold back in April?
Exactly. He sold a short futures contract at the old high price of $5.50. Now that the broader market price has fallen, the futures price has also fallen.
Because they moved together.
Right. Let's say the futures price is now $4.10. To close out his short position, he buys back those futures contracts at $4.10.
So he sold high at $5.50 and he bought low at $4.10.
Yep. That is a profit of $1.40 per bushel in his futures account.
So let's marry the two accounts together for the listener. He sold his physical corn for $4 at the elevator, but he made $1.40 in the futures market.
Let's do the math.
$4 plus $1.40 equals a net effective selling price of $5.40.
Boom.
The giant pile of money he makes in his futures account perfectly offsets the giant pile of money he lost at the grain elevator. He effectively locked in his selling price the day he planted the seeds.
And this brings up a really important underlying concept that makes hedging work at all. It's called convergence.
The convergence.
Ah.
Why did the futures price drop alongside the cash price?
Because as a futures contract approaches its expiration date, the cash price and the futures price must converge. They have to.
What happens if they don't?
If they didn't, arbitragers would step in.
Hmm.
They would buy the cheap cash commodity, sell the expensive futures contract, and deliver the physical goods for a risk-free profit.
Free money. And the market hates free money.
Exactly. That arbitrage forces the two prices together. So when Fred's local cash price crashed, he knew the futures price was crashing with it, ensuring his short position would be profitable.
That is such a vital piece of the puzzle. The whole system relies on convergence. And this anticipatory short hedge strategy isn't just for farmers, right?
Not at all. If we connect this to the broader global economy, this applies to any commercial producer.
Give me some examples.
Imagine a copper miner in Chile. They are blasting rock and digging ore out of the ground today, but they won't have refined copper cathodes to sell for 6 months.
Okay, so they are anticipating a sale.
Right. Or an oil producer in Texas who is drilling a new well but won't deliver the barrels until next quarter. Anyone who has output coming to the market later and fears falling prices uses an anticipatory short hedge.
Okay, here is where my brain completely short-circuited when I first read this material.
Yeah.
And this is a massive exam trap.
Oh, this one gets everyone.
The exam will give you a scenario exactly like this. They'll say, Farmer Fred just planted his seeds. He owns absolutely zero harvested corn today. Is he a long hedger or a short hedger?
Right.
The trap is that your brain reads the words, he owns nothing today, and intuitively thinks, well, if he doesn't own anything, he can't be short. You have to own something to short it.
Yep. It makes perfect logical sense to a normal person.
And so people select long hedger on the multiple choice.
Yeah.
And they fail the question.
It's incredibly common. And the reason people fail it is because they are mixing up the cash market and the futures market.
They are two different things.
Yes. The term short in the phrase short hedger refers exclusively to the action taken in the futures leg. It does not refer to physical ownership.
So because he is going to be a seller of the physical commodity later, he sells futures today.
Exactly. He is a short hedger, period. End of story.
Okay, so that is the seller side of the equation. Let's completely flip the script and look at the buyers. Because for every seller in a market, there is a buyer on the other side of the trade.
A buyer who is just as terrified of price movement.
Right. This brings us to the anticipatory long hedge. Let's introduce another character. Meet Processor Paula.
Processor Paula, what does Paula do?
Paula runs a massive industrial scale factory that makes those delicious, highly addictive, neon orange triangle corn chips. You know the ones?
Oh, absolutely know the ones.
Good. So Paula looks at her complex production schedule. She has contracts to supply major grocery chains all over the country. She knows, with mathematical certainty, that she will need to buy thousands of tons of raw physical corn in exactly 3 months to keep her factory running.
But she hasn't bought the corn yet.
No, she hasn't bought it yet. Mm-hmm. So Paula is in the exact opposite situation as Farmer Fred. She doesn't have a product to sell into the market. She has a raw material that she absolutely must buy from the market.
Right. So listener, it's time for another pause. Direct question to you. If you're driving, pay attention to this. What keeps Processor Paula awake at night? Give it a beat. Think about it.
What's her nightmare?
Paula's nightmare is a massive price rise before she actually buys her raw materials.
Right. Because she has to buy it.
Yes. If a terrible drought hits the Midwest and the price of raw corn skyrockets over the next 3 months, her cost of manufacturing those chips goes through the roof.
And let's dig into the business reality of that for a second. Why doesn't Paula just raise the price of her chips at the grocery store? Like, if corn goes up, just charge the consumer more.
Right. In a perfect world, sure. But in the real world, consumer products have high price elasticity.
Meaning people won't just pay whatever she asks.
Exactly. If Paula raises the price of a bag of chips from $4 to $7, consumers will just walk down the aisle and buy pretzels or potato chips or store brand crackers.
She will face massive demand destruction.
Yes. She cannot easily pass those raw material costs onto the consumer. So if corn prices spike, her profit margins don't just shrink, they get entirely wiped out. She could operate her factory at a loss.
So Paula needs to lock in her purchase price right now, today, to protect her factory's margins. How does she do it? She takes action by buying futures.
She goes long in the futures market.
Let's translate that back to exam terminology.
Processor Paula has a short anticipated cash position.
Short anticipated cash.
Because she needs something she doesn't have.
Correct. She is short the cash market because she is committed to buying physical commodities in the future that she does not currently possess.
Got it.
When you are short the physical commodity, when you need it to run your business, but you don't have it, your fear is always that the price of that commodity will go up.
So let's walk through Paula's offset mechanism month by month, just like we did with Fred. It's April. December, corn futures are at $5.50.
Same starting point.
Yep. Paula runs her profit margin calculations and realizes that 550 corn allows her to make a healthy profit on her chips. So she buys December corn futures at 550.
She's long futures. Now, fast forward to October. Her nightmare comes true. A massive drought devastated the crop. Corn prices climbed to record highs.
Exactly. The local cash price at the grain elevator where she usually buys her corn has spiked to $7 a bushel.
$7. She has no choice, though. She has to keep the factory running. She goes out into the cash market and pays an absolute fortune, $7 a bushel, for the physical corn.
Her manufacturing costs just exploded.
She takes a massive financial hit on her physical operations. By T, she bought those long futures contracts back in April.
Because of that beautiful concept of convergence we talked about earlier, the futures price spiked right alongside the cash price. The December futures contract is now trading at $7.10.
Okay, so let's track the trade. She bought those futures at $5.50.
Right. She now sells her long futures position to close it out at $7.10. Buy low, sell high. She makes a profit of $1.60 per bushel in her futures account.
So let's marry Paula's accounts together. She paid a painful $7 for the physical corn, but she made $1.60 in the futures market.
Let's do the math again.
$7 minus the $1.60 profit equals a net effective purchase price of $5.40.
Amazing.
Just like Farmer Fred, that gain in her futures account offset the expensive physical corn she had to buy. She effectively locked in her raw material costs months in advance, completely ignoring the drought.
And this is where we have to flag another massive linguistic trap that the exam loves to set. You really got to pay close attention to how they use everyday English words against you here.
Yes. The exam will try to use the word anticipatory to lead you down the wrong path.
How so?
They will write a question and try to make you subconsciously think that anticipatory automatically means long futures. Why? Because in normal everyday English, when you anticipate something, it usually implies you are looking forward to receiving it.
Oh, that makes sense. Like you anticipate a gift or you anticipate a vacation.
Exactly. It implies getting something, being long something.
Right. They weaponize the dictionary definition of the word. But as we just spent 20 minutes proving with Fred and Paula, anticipatory hedges come in both directions.
Both directions.
A future seller anticipates a sale, so they go short. A future buyer anticipates a purchase, so they go long. You cannot just read the word anticipatory in a question stem and assume the future's direction.
You have to look past the adjective and find the underlying business need.
Exactly.
Okay, so to really cement this knowledge, we need to strip away the stories for a second. We need to look at the raw mechanics side by side. Let's set up a direct comparison between two people who are both going to sell grain, but are in very different situations.
Do it.
We have Elevator Edgar, who is managing a giant concrete grain silo that is currently packed to the brim with harvested dry grain. That is an ordinary hedge.
Because he has the physical product right now.
Right. And we have Farmer Fred, whose corn is still just seeds in the dirt. That is an anticipatory hedge.
If we look closely at Edgar and Fred, we have to ask, what is the core similarity between them?
It's their fear. Yeah.
It's their fear. Elevator Edgar has physical grain sitting in a silo. By the way, running a grain elevator isn't free. He has to pay for insurance against fire. He has to pay for aeration fans to keep the grain from rotting. He's paying for rat poison. He's paying interest on the money he borrowed to buy that grain from the local farmers.
That sounds like a lot of overhead.
It is. This is all called the cost of carry. Because of this, he desperately fears falling prices because his expensive inventory will lose value every single day it sits there.
And Farmer Fred, with his corn in the dirt, fears falling prices because his future harvest will lose value.
Exactly. They both fear the exact same macroeconomic event.
They both will ultimately sell grain to the market in the future. Therefore, their action in the futures market must be identical. They both sell futures.
That is exactly right. The market doesn't care about their specific logistical circumstances.
So here is the golden rule. I want you to mentally highlight this. Write it on your bathroom mirror. Make it your phone wallpaper. The futures side of the equation never, ever asks whether you own anything right now.
It just doesn't care.
The futures market does not care if your corn is in a steel silo or buried in the mud. It only asks one single question. Will you ultimately sell the physical commodity, or will you ultimately BUY the physical commodity?
That is the perfect way to distill it. If you translate that into a summary table, it is incredibly straightforward. A future seller of the physical commodity sells futures. A future buyer of the physical commodity buys futures.
Whether that physical cash position is sitting safely in a warehouse today or it's still 3 months away from existing changes absolutely nothing about the future's like.
Right. And the NFA will throw dense four-sentence paragraphs of distracting backstory at you. They will talk about warehouse receipts and planting seasons and El Nino weather forecasts and storage costs.
Ignore all of it. Cut through the noise and just ask, is this person fundamentally a future buyer or a future seller? Boom. You have your future's leg.
Okay, so up to this point, we have perfectly isolated and understood the futures leg. We know exactly how to determine if someone is going long or going short in the futures market based on their business needs. But now we have to enter the matrix.
Uh-oh, the matrix.
We have to tackle the exam's absolute favorite way to rename these hedgers, disguise their positions, and totally confuse you.
Oh boy. Here we go. It's time to talk about the basis.
We need to define this explicitly mathematically right out of the gate. For the purposes of this exam and the formula used throughout your CertFuel course material, the basis is defined as the cash price, which is also known as the spot price minus the futures price.
Cash minus futures.
Cash minus futures.
Cash minus futures. I'm going to say it again. Cash minus futures. Okay, so because it's a simple subtraction equation, the result, the basis, it can be either a positive number or a negative number.
Yeah, correct. If the cash price is higher than the futures price, you have a positive basis. If the cash price is lower than the futures price, you have a negative basis. And let's quickly touch on why they are different at all. Why isn't the cash price just exactly the same as the futures price?
Right. If a bushel of corn is a bushel of corn, why are there two prices?
Because of logistics and reality.
Explain that.
The futures price is typically a benchmark based on delivery at a highly specific location, like Chicago. The cash price is what they are paying right now at your local grain elevator in rural Iowa. The difference between those two prices, the basis, is driven by local supply and demand, transportation costs, and storage.
So, like, if there's a massive shortage of trains in Iowa.
Exactly. If you can't move your grain to Chicago, the local cash price will plummet because the grain is stuck.
Dang.
But the Chicago futures price might spike because they are starved for supply.
Yeah.
That causes the basis to shift wildly.
Okay, that makes it feel much more tangible. It's not just an abstract math formula. It's the cost of reality. Now, here is where people get tangled up on the exam. The NFA doesn't just want to know if the basis is mathematically positive or negative. It wants to know if the basis is strengthening or weakening.
And this is where linguistic intuition totally betrays people.
Exactly. This is where my ADHD brain used to just short circuit. Because the words strong and weak feel like they should correlate perfectly with positive and negative. Strong means positive, weak means negative.
And it makes sense to think that.
But they don't. So the absolute best mental model I found for this is just picturing a standard number line. We all learned this in third grade. Zero is in the middle. Positive numbers go off to the right. Negative numbers go off to the left.
Okay, I'm visualizing the number line. Zero in the middle.
Now, here is the absolute key to understanding basis movement. Anytime the basis moves to the right on that number line in the positive direction, it is called strengthening.
Moving to the right is strengthening.
Yes. And it does not matter where you start on the line. If you move right, it strengthens. If you start at positive 10 and move to positive 20, it's strengthened.
And here is the counterintuitive part. If you start at negative 50 and move to negative 40, it still strengthened because you moved to the right. You became less negative.
Yes. And conversely, anytime the basis moves to the left on the number line in the negative direction, it is called weakening. Again, doesn't matter where you start. If you start at positive 30 and drop to positive 10, it weakened.
Because it went left.
Right. If you start at negative 10 and drop to negative 30, it weakened. It became more negative.
Okay, listener, let's test this right now. Direct question for you. Picture your number line. You can even draw it in the air with your finger.
Seriously, do it.
If the basis goes from 35 cents under futures, which is exam speak, for negative 35 to 30 cents under futures, which is negative 30, did the basis strengthen or did it weaken? Give it a beat. Think about it.
Did it strengthen or weaken?
The answer is that it strengthened.
It strengthened.
It went from negative 35 and it moved to the right to negative 30.
Listen, the trap here is your own brain tricking you into thinking that negative means weak. The exam will show you a basis that is negative 30, and you will desperately want to select weakened.
Do not do it.
Do not do it.
Yeah.
Strengthen and weaken describe the direction of the change, the velocity, not the static sign in front of the number. If it moves to the right, it strengthens. If it moves to the left, it weakens.
That number line is a phenomenal visual. If you just draw a quick horizontal line on your dry erase board at the testing center the second you sit down, you will never get a strengthening or weakening question wrong.
Okay, so we have the math of the vases down. We know how to track it on a number line.
Right.
We know why it exists in the real world. Now we have to connect this math back to our characters. How does the concept of basis attach to Farmer Fred?
Let's bring him back.
Let's dive into Long the Basis, which is the short hedger in disguise.
Let's bring Farmer Fred back to the front of the class. Remember, Fred is our anticipatory short hedger. He's growing corn, he fears a price drop, so he sold futures.
Right, we established that.
Well, the exam is going to take Farmer Fred, and instead of clearly calling him a short hedger, they are going to refer to him as being Long the Basis.
Okay, I have to push back here. This is maddening. This is exactly what I mean when I say this material is intentionally direction flippable. Why on earth is the short hedger called Long the Basis?
It's a lot of terminology.
That feels like they made it confusing entirely on purpose just to fail people. Like, I'm short futures. How can I be long anything?
It does feel like a cruel regulatory joke, but there is actually a very elegant logic to it if we step back and look at the underlying cash position. What does Farmer Fred actually own?
He owns the physical commodity.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Right. He is long the cash market. Because he owns a physical commodity, he has effectively bought the basis. Let's think about what the basis is. The basis is just a measurement of the value of the physical cash market relative to the futures market.
Okay, I'm following.
Since Fred owns the physical cash commodity, he essentially owns the basis. He is long the basis.
Okay, let me try an analogy to see if I have this right. It's like owning a house or owning a share of Apple stock. When you own a house, you are long real estate.
Yes.
And when you own something, when you hold the deed to it, what do you want the value of that thing to do? You want it to go UP.
Exactly. You want your assets to appreciate. And we just established that for the basis, going UP or moving to the right on our number line is called strengthening.
Okay, so.
Therefore, a long basis hedger, the person who owns the physical commodity, benefits when the basis strengthens. When the basis widens in the cash market's favor, it means the physical corn he holds is becoming more valuable relative to the futures market. It actively raises his net selling price.
So if I am Farmer Fred and I own the physical corn, I am long the basis. Mm-hmm. I want the value of what I own to increase. So I want the basis to move to the right on the number line. I want it to strengthen.
Yeah.
But what if it goes the other way? What if the basis weakens? What if it moves to the left and loses value?
Mm. If the basis weakens, that actively hurts him. It means the cash market is dropping faster than the futures market or rising slower. Either way, the local value of his corn is deteriorating relative to the benchmark. It lowers his net selling price at the grain elevator.
This is huge. Long the basis means you are short futures. Let me say that again because it's the most common mistake on this entire test. Long the basis means you are short futures.
The labels are opposite.
The basis label is the exact opposite of the futures leg. When you read the phrase long the basis on a question, your brain must immediately translate that to, okay, they own the physical cash, which means they're a future seller, which means their futures leg is short.
You have to do that translation step.
Do not let the word long trick you into thinking they bought futures.
And that perfectly sets up the other side of the coin. If Farmer Fred is long the basis, what about Processor Paula, our corn chip manufacturer?
Well, Paula is our anticipatory long hedger. She needs to buy corn in the future. She fears a price rise, so she bought futures. According to the exact opposite logic, Processor Paula is short the basis.
Right. And let's explain the why behind that label so we aren't just memorizing opposites. Paula has a short anticipated cash position. She does not own the physical commodity yet. She has a massive looming obligation to buy it.
Right.
Because she is on the wrong side of ownership, meaning she needs something she doesn't currently have. She is effectively short the basis.
So if we go back to my analogy, being short the basis is exactly like shorting a stock in the regular equity market.
Okay, how so?
When you short a stock, you borrow it, sell it, and you sit there hoping the price crashes so you can buy it back cheaper. When you're short something, you want its value to go down.
Precisely. You want the asset you owe it to depreciate. And for the basis, going down or moving to the left on our number line is called weakening. Processor Paula, because she is short the basis, benefits when the basis weakens.
That makes total sense.
When the basis narrows or falls in her favor, it means the local cash market is getting cheaper relative to the futures market.
But
it lowers her net purchase price for the physical corn she has to buy for her factory.
So if the basis strengthens, if it moves to the right and gains value, that actively hurts Paula.
Yes, it does.
Because she is short, a rising value means the local cash market is getting more expensive, which means she has to pay more for her raw materials, which crushes her profit margins.
It is exactly right.
So to reiterate the trap here, short the basis means you are long futures. You must match the basis label to the cash position, not the futures position, or you will fail the question.
Match it to the cash position.
Short the basis means she is short the physical cash, which means she has to buy it later, which means she is long futures today.
Okay, we have thrown a massive amount of moving parts at you over the last hour. We've talked about ordinary versus anticipatory timing, short futures, long futures, cost of carry, convergence, number lines, strengthening, weakening, long basis, and short basis.
That's a lot. My head is spinning.
Before we finish, we have to weave all of these distinct threads together into a single, unbreakable mental map. Because on exam day, when you are on question 85 and your brain is tired, you are not going to have time to derive all of this from scratch. You need a matrix.
Yes, we need to synthesize this. Let's dynamically walk through this master matrix, side by side, step by step. Let's start with the seller, the short hedger.
The short hedger. Their cash position is that they are long the physical commodity. They either own it now, like Elevator Edgar, or they will produce it soon, like Farmer Fred.
Because they will ultimately sell it into the market, their futures leg is short futures.
Because they own the physical cash, their basis position is long the basis.
And because they are long the basis, they want the value of what they own to go up, which means they want the basis to strengthen.
Beautiful. Now let's do the buyer, the long hedger. Their cash position is short or anticipated short. They need to buy the physical commodity, like Professor Paula.
Because they will ultimately buy it from the market, their futures leg is long futures.
Because they are short the physical cash, their basis position is short the basis.
And because they are short the basis, they want the value to go down, which means they want the basis to weaken.
If you can write that matrix out on your scratch paper the second you sit down in the testing center, you will be bulletproof on this entire section.
And to help you memorize it, what is the ultimate memory aid? How do we lock this in so it never leaves your brain?
Here is the killer mnemonic to take with you. Own the cash, you are long the basis. Owners want their holding to rise, so a stronger basis helps.
Let me repeat that. Own the cash, you are long the basis. Owners want their holding to rise, so a stronger basis helps.
If you just memorize that one sentence, you can derive the entire rest of the matrix.
That is gold. That is absolute gold. Okay, we are in the home stretch here. It's time for a rapid fire recap. I'm going to fire questions at you, and our expert is going to give you the one sentence rule for each. Listener, I want you trying to answer these out loud in your car or wherever you are before the expert does. Here we go. Question one. Does an anticipatory hedge change the future's direction compared to an ordinary hedge? Give it a beat. Think about it.
No, the timing changes, but the market mechanics do not.
Question two. If a basis moves from negative 35 to negative 40, is it strengthening or weakening? Think about your number line.
Weakening. It became more negative, meaning it moved left on the number line.
Question three. If you are short futures, what is your basis position? Give it a second.
Long the basis label is the exact opposite of the futures leg.
Question four. What does a long hedger want the basis to do? Final question.
Weaken. A long hedger is short the basis, and shorts want the value to fall.
Nailed it. If you got those right, you are in phenomenal shape for this section of the exam.
I want to leave you with a final, slightly provocative thought to mull over as you continue studying.
Oh, I like a provocative thought.
We've spent a lot of time talking about the math and how these hedges perfectly offset cash losses in a spreadsheet. But think about the real-world risk of an anticipatory hedge failing.
Like the metal Gesellschaft example.
Exactly. Let's go back to Farmer Fred one last time. What if Fred's entire crop gets completely wiped out by a massive 100-year flood in July?
Oh, man.
He no longer has any physical corn to sell at harvest, but he still holds that short futures contract he sold back in April. Because the physical side disappeared, he has accidentally turned from a conservative hedger into a pure, naked speculator overnight.
That is terrifying.
If corn prices skyrocket after that flood because everyone else's crop got destroyed too, he will lose an absolute fortune on his short futures position, and he has no cash crop to sell to offset the loss.
Because he has no corn.
Right. The exam tests you on when things go right and how the mechanics work in a vacuum. But out in the real world, the basis is only half the battle. Mother Nature is the other.
That is a terrifying and entirely realistic thought to end on. It really puts the risk in risk management. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep reviewing your notes, keep drawing those number lines, and keep crushing your Series 3 prep. And remember, when you step into that diagnostic landscape of the exam and the paragraphs try to muddy the waters, just cut through the noise and look for the underlying cache position. The entire structure will become clear. Keep studying hard.